Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Oh, that was me. That's why you sounded weird.
You're weird?
Because that was my voice. I have a deeper voice than you. I didn't realize I have a deeper voice than you. Is that real?
Yeah, totally, man. You never realized that before?
I hadn't until just now.
I thought you were like, that's the whole point about you doing your R&B project.
Did you hear that beautiful song I was playing?
Yes, Benny, I heard that beautiful song.
Dirty.
Come on, take those pants off, Brad. Take them off.
Yeah. Bernie,
yeah.
You don't have a deeper voice than me.
I definitely do. You sound like a six-year-old trying to get into a bar or something. All right, let's talk about something real fast because I figured something out because of one of our exchanges again.
Do you want me to stop recording?
No.
Oh,
no. Okay.
We're going to figure this out in public?
Well, it's because I had it kind of had an interesting point to it at the end. So this morning, you text me, I ask you a question, and you're like, I'm fucking waffling. I take it as you're making waffles for your kids. So I'm like, Jesus Christ, Brad, I have fucking kids too, Like, I'm busy. I get it. And I write back like, yeah, dude, I just made pancakes and, I got to drive the kids to school. I fucking get it. Obviously sassy. And you're like, dude, I was talking about like waffling, like I'm waffling over my decision. I'm like, oh, okay. Text is stupid. But the one thing I realized through this exchange
was that you're a better dad because you make pancakes for your kids.
No, that didn't come into play. I think any dad who feels like they're a great dad is, I don't know, we're all fucking up every day, right? But the thing I realized is that I think text has potentially like ruined a lot of relationships for me. I had been having a hard time coming to grips with the fact that I'm like, why am I not friends with this person anymore? Like, what's going on? Am I like a dick? Am I, I know I'm a little harsh, but it's like, what's happening? And now I realize something. I think that people from New Jersey and New York, specifically people like me, text is bad for us. And it's because in a public setting, when you're in someone, in front of their face, if you follow up any remark with a nice, wry smile, and a little like slap on the shoulder just to be like, yo, I'm just fucking with you, dog. I'm just fucking with you. And then all of a sudden, like it's over and it's cool because your intention is so clear. Like even if you stepped over the line,
right,
your intention is so clear that you're fucking around. You're just having a little fun, Sorry if I went a little too far, And then it stops there and nobody cares. But I feel like I carried my same projection as like a, old trashy Jersey guy. Like I brought it over to text and I just kept making like the same types of comments to people, but without getting to like smile and slap them on the shoulder. And then they're just like, oh man, that was harsh.
I think people realized this early on and that's why they invented emoji.
Oh, to express emotions.
Yeah. So that when you say you're a fucking dick, then you put a little smiley face.
Right. But isn't LOL like the new, like, bless your heart? You know how, like, you're in the South And as long as they say like bless your heart first, they think they're legally allowed to say anything they want afterwards, right. Like the meanest shit.
Right.
I think LOL is the new one. It's like, you know, you could say the worst thing, like, hey, you looked like super fat in those clothes and I didn't like it at all. LOL. You know? It's like your excuse to say anything.
You got to, because there's a whole thing about email and texting both make everything sound meaner no matter what, even if you're not fooling around. Just like any comment you make.
I know.
Any fact, it sounds mean.
And I've kind of realized that because like my whole vibe, even though I'm like a really sweet guy, I sound kind of mean. I always have, you know, it's very pointed language. It's short, you know, I get right to the meat of it, you know, and I can't believe it took me all this time to put it together, but I realized this morning, I'm like, oh, well, that could be the problem to all this. I should call more people. I wish it didn't take like 15 years to sort out or something. I was
professing my like sort of, you know, a moment of weakness where I just couldn't make a decision and I felt bad.
I know. And I took it all wrong. I thought you were like, Benny, I'm making waffles for my kids. I'm like, yo, your kids are like old enough to make their own fucking waffles. Come on. We could like watch their own.
I didn't say I'm making waffles. I said I'm waffling.
I know.
Like the way I talk over here. Today we're waffling. Tomorrow perhaps we'll be granolaing.
Wednesday is egging day. Yeah. So that was a realization I had again through one of our text exchanges, Brad.
It's good to be aware.
I know. I just,
because this is the medium of our time. So,
well, it's sort of a double-edged sword for me because the answer to so many of my problems in life is shut the fuck up. Right. But like, I'm getting into like, now I'm in this business. I'm in a talking business, you know?
Yeah, you are.
I'm supposed to be Gabby, and I'm probably, who knows what I'm going to say if we keep doing this. This is going to be a problem.
They're waiting to hear.
I know. Well, luckily we had Corey Brandon, who you like, I don't think you can even offend Corey Brandon, you know?
He can't offend me, man. That's for sure.
I love it. And I was doing research for this and getting into it, listening to Corey's records again and just being like, man, sometimes I forget how fucking good this guy is.
Yeah.
You know, his whole approach to lyricism, drawing from those, you know, the John Prines and the Randy Newmans and kind of finding that silver lining, that dark tinge to happy things. It's like, really, that's why I asked him if he's a satirist, because there's this weird like Mark Twain-y kind of quality to like the way you're explaining things, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And really cool and really smart, you know? It's packaged in a way that you wouldn't always get. And then you're listening to it and you're like, wow, this is fucking smart. It's really good.
And a badass guitar player.
Yeah. Like the baddest ass. If you go on tour with Corey, it's just hilarious to watch every guitar player on tour just fucking fawning over Corey. Like every time he's playing a show, they're on the side going like, what is he even doing?
Right.
That's crazy. And then behind the stage, they're basically like, hey, how do you do that? You know, and Corey's so chill. He just shows everybody everything. So yeah, but great guy to be on the road with too. Just such a cool cucumber, no problems, you know? I had a great chat with him here too. I want to see his horror movie. His horror movie is going to be great.
Yeah, I want him to score a horror movie. That's what we need to get him.
What do we have? Jenny Owens Young as the lead in Corey Brandon's horror movie. This is three episodes in a row that we have come up with some serious, serious movie pitches. Oh, and big development this morning that I sent you. Old Judd Apatow getting onto the thread, liking Noel Wells' idea for a movie. So apparently, oh my teasing, Judd Apatow is a fan of Going Off Track.
Thanks
for listening again, Judd. Thanks for tuning in to the Corey episode. I really enjoy your films. You seem like a nice guy.
Let's talk.
Yeah, like if you're ever down in my area in the Forest River Valley, you know, I'll buy you a coffee, you know?
we'll discuss some of these ideas we've got going on.
Or maybe you'll buy me a fucking coffee, Judd. Huh? Yeah.
That'd be more appropriate.
Maybe I'll make him pay. If you want to pay us a little money, we fund the program through a website called Patreon, which is where you sign up in different tiers for exclusive content, videos, photos, pictures of me wearing funny masks, content that we don't get to anybody else, just some random blabber, and our Thursday night fireside chat on Discord, which you can only have access to with the Patreon. So, I don't know. You should sign up for it. It's good fun.
At patreon.com/goingofftrack.
Your voice is not deeper than mine. This is nice to realize. I like this. But anyway, Corey's got a beautiful voice. Let's listen to him talk. It's going off track! Hey, Brad, as an engineer, like, how many times in your life has someone told you to check something and you've had to go like 2, 3, 4? Like, isn't it ever your instinct to just mix it up?
Instead of go 1, 2, 3?
Yeah, like just say anything else, you know?
When I was on stage, I used to just do the ABC song.
You would sing the ABC song?
Yeah, yeah.
I found that platypus and syphilis work, you know, to get any trouble.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, get those tricky S's out of the way.
Yeah, yeah. To get the sibilance. That's good. That's a good one. Yeah.
I feel like everybody goes through that period where they're like, all right, I'm bored of 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to start messing around with some different stuff. But then it almost becomes like a challenge to yourself. You know, where like those days you don't feel like coming up with anything, and then you revert back to 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you just stay there.
When I first started playing in bands, yeah, I just did 1, 2, 3, 4. And then I actually started learning like engineering. I did a little house sound and I realized like that doesn't really help. So you got to do what you're going to actually do in your performance. So
Absolutely.
That's why I came up with I didn't want to acapella anything else except for ABCD. A B C D F G.
When I'm playing with a band, I always, you know, you want to give them everything or whatever, but then I always hold back about 10%, you know, because I just, you know, right. I kind of want to cheat the trick and, you know, just have them not duck me.
What's your go-to mic check, Corey? You just say syphilis over and over again?
Syphilis and platypus and, you know.
Do you understand what I'm talking about, Corey? That instinct to like, all right, yeah. It's like my 110th day in a row. I just don't want to say 1, 2, 3, 4.
You know, it's a long drive, probably a long drive to the gig. You know, you don't always have to be on.
Yeah, that's what I feel like. If you mix it up, you get that pressure. Or have you ever toured with like a sound engineer who just like every single day, you know, like just runs the same song through the PA when they get there? Which logistically I understand because, you know, you want
to... My sound engineer. I've never had a sound engineer. But yeah, when I opened up for, when I opened up for Gaslight or when I opened up for anybody. Yeah, I think y'all's dude would do, have a cigar? Could be wrong. Maybe that was tour, dude.
Yeah, I think that might have been different. Joe, who was with Gaslight for a long time, always used to use the same No Doubt song. Which, again, you grow to like love and hate these songs. We had a sound person once who apparently used to play a dance track that was her singing on it. And just some really, so you kind of grow to like, you know, they turn into those like narrative songs that.
All this is coming back to me now. I think Isbell's guy uses a Steely Dan song. I think he uses Deacon Blue. But yeah, Have a Cigar in retrospect was pretty good because it has that big synth sweep in it.
You know, right.
It goes all the way from like the highest frequency to the lowest frequency. So
sure.
I guess technically that's a damn good song for it.
I mean, I guess the object for those songs really, it's not as much about the song, but it's like whatever song, you know, how it's supposed to sound perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess like you can base it off that.
Read the room.
Yeah. It's familiarity, whatever you're familiar with.
Wow. Yeah. I told you, Corey. I told you, Brad reads tape op. Sometimes it goes this way, you know.
I think I stopped getting the tape op. Finally, they stopped being able to track me down. But for a long time, I had it, and I didn't re up. But they would still send them, and I moved places, and then they would show up. It was like a monkey paw thing. I just was like, I didn't like this thing is just following me everywhere.
They're like, please read us, read us.
I mean, it's a great magazine, but you know, it was mostly trash liner.
I've only read Tape Op like 6 minutes at a time while shitting at recording studios.
Yeah.
That's the breadth of my tape op fandom is that.
That's enough.
Yeah, that's enough. So what's up with you, Corey?
You're looking at it. Jack shit, like everybody.
Yeah.
You know, just trying to tread water, find ever more interesting side hustles.
Yeah, right. So you're doing the quarantunes and trying to convert yourself digitally. But how are you doing, like, just for yourself on like a day to day level? Like, what are you doing when you get up in the morning to face this new world we got?
Well, morning's a loose noun for when I get up. But yeah, it's I don't know. Yeah, up and down. You know, I've sort of won the lottery as far as who I'm going to be locked up with for a year and a half. My boy's he's 8 now, and my brain's not working. I think that's how old he is. It's been a long quarantine. But my wife, you know, she's like a killer cook, so I kind of win there. Yeah, no, it's sort of a really fun hang, but we're all losing our minds, of course.
Right.
And I don't leave the house. Like, right. You know, I mean, I've been out. It's ridiculous. I did go to a lot of drive-in movies. We have a drive-in here in Memphis.
Oh, nice.
And it's same one I've been going to since I was a kid. And actually, I have a gig, which is crazy. Playing at the drive-in later this month with Lucero and American Aquarium, which I'm just stoked about. Yeah, I would get out and go see just whatever garbage movies they had there. Every once in a while, they would do a B-movie thing with
Is it like contemporary stuff, like new movies?
Yeah, no, it's new movies, and then they would have some retro stuff here and there, and then Black Lodge, which is our local video store that has all the cult videos and things, and they would mm-hmm. do a throwback night where you've got, you know, I don't know, a Charles Bronson film or something that's awesome. That's been it. That's been my year. But like you said, sort of learning, I just went down the rabbit hole with all this recording stuff and having to learn. I put a different hat on and had to learn what a DAW was. You know.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, it even forced me, the drummer. The lunk-headed drummer who should have never gotten past like 1971 to buy an interface. It even happened to me.
But hey, what you running there? What kind of interface you running there?
Oh, I got a Focusrite. It's real nice.
Nothing wrong with that.
I don't know. The guy I did the other podcast with is like, "Hey man, this is like what you need. I'm going to send it to you." And I'm like, cool. That's the only way it's going to get done. So you're a smarter man than me.
If you can come turn it on for me every day and put my headphones on me.
Exactly. So how's your, how are you disciplining it? Like, are you none?
Sorry, just that word.
Just none. Are we talking like it's you're jazz. In a robe for four days?
I'm in a robe right now.
You are.
Yeah, I've got my depression robe on. It's pretty much
good.
You took my
pants thing seriously then.
It's my uniform. I'm in a robe all the time. The other day, what was it? Somebody came to the door, and so I put on clothes and 7 masks and answered the door, and then I went right back in and put my robe back on. I was like, this doesn't feel right. Yeah,
you couldn't even commit to a full day of full clothing?
No. Yeah, the mother-in-law came by, and she's obviously going for the obvious, the easy target. Call me Lebowski. but I sort of picture myself a little more Harry Nielsen, cover Nielsen right. Schmielsen with the hash pipe. Yeah.
Is it a nice robe?
Yes, it's a very nice robe. It's the greatest gift anyone's gotten me. My father-in-law got it for me 10 years ago from a Restoration Hardware. It is very nice. It's great. The pocket's falling off. It's just whatever. It's like a mix. It's one of those you know, choose your own adventure colors. It's when you look at it, it's kind of gray. It's kind of purple. It's kind of brown. It's I showed it to Laura Jane Grace and she's like, that's the exact color of depression. Right? My depression room.
So the shoe fits.
Yeah, it's great.
Are you doing those like Instagram sessions and stuff? I think I've seen you in clothes for those, right?
I do. I wear clothes. The last little thing I did, a little Q&A thing, I just gave up and wore the robe. But I've gotten dressed I try not to do a lot of online shows just because it's so, you know, I don't know. I feel like...
Shitty?
Well, yeah. I feel weird. There's a disconnect, you know?
Yeah,
It's like the song ends and it's, you know, and there's just no... Tappy.
Little hearts. Yeah, your shows are pretty interactive with the audience normally.
Yeah,
that's a pretty rough or a weird difference for you, I'd assume.
It's like miming your life. It's I don't know, some disconnect there. But I've done my best to make it sound good. Yeah, I see a lot of people just sort of phone these things in and stuff. So I did that. And also, I just feel sort of like the hat's out, you know, it feels a little busking. Nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with making a living. I mean, we got to.
No, I know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah. But initially, that's why I did that that little show I was doing. I was doing a, you know, a little interview thing where I interviewed my songwriting buddies.
Yeah.
And I would do that. You know, I was like, okay, here's the thing I can do that's... a good distraction, where there's no, you know, there's no hat out.
Right. Sure.
And then I had to just end those after a while. But trying to just keep busy.
Now that's something you kind of struggle with even in pre-pandemic is this idea of like, I don't know, maybe just on the surface, like it looks like you're doing something for money is something that really, really, you know, leaves a awful taste in your mouth. Like I know you're always very functional about the idea that like, hey, I got to pay my bills and music is the thing to do it, but you don't want to go outside of that. Do you think like this new, you know, potentially semi-permanent digital age we're in is going to like, you know, benefit the people who are more willing to put themselves out there like that?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, that's the sea change, the newest sea change. This fucking business has changed out from under me three times since I started, I guess.
Yeah.
I started right at the end of, 99, 2000. You could maybe still sort of make a living. And then, you know, the digital... sweeping the rug out from under, you know, and releasing records is like pouring a cup of water in the ocean. It's all spread out in a very thin pixelated layer, you know, theoretically democratic, you know,
right.
My stuff can reach more people. I'm like, well, yeah, reach more people. If I don't know, it's like, yeah, like a radio wave, maybe if they build their own kit. And search every frequency, you know, it's, I don't know.
Right, but, right.
Yeah, it's, and it, I don't know, but yeah, now you have, I would not be doing social media. That is exactly, I mean, it suits my obsessive nature, you know, to always be checking and looking things, but I'm not a social person for the most part. And, the 24/7 blitz of self-promotion that it takes to, I don't know. I don't know if that's a thing that works for people. That's great. It's just not natural for me. And, I like the idea of getting on here, this thing and just being like, every once in a while, I'll take the mask down and like, here's what's going on right now. You know,
sure,
like, and it's like, it's almost like just poking the bear a little bit. I'm like, hey, here's a little truth on this little app here.
Right.
But for the most part, it's just, you know, it's just dumb jokes and whatever B movies I'm watching.
So what B movies are you watching?
I watched The Beyond yesterday, an amazing piece of Italian, bizarro gonzo film. I just mainly a lot of early horror and like, the more palatable exploitation stuff that I can watch. Yeah, some of it's fun, and some of it's like, oh, good Lord. I watched about 20 minutes of a documentary on Nazi exploitation. I was like, what the fuck is Nazi exploitation? And I got about 20 minutes into the documentary. I was like, no, we're going to go wash my eyes.
Good on that.
It was a whole thing. It was a whole thing. And like, it was a lot of it was Italian, and they were working out some sort of like, you know, national psychic thing they had. Maybe that's being generous. They were just trying to fucking make money off of essentially porn. But there was this whole thing, you know, about the Italians' collaboration with the Nazis, you know, like there's this whole sort of national guilt they may have been exercising.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what interested me a little bit. And then I was just like, I was watching it. I was like, oh, no, this is not for me.
Yeah. I mean,
this is not for anyone, really, but
too soon. Too soon, Italy, you know, come on. This wasn't that long ago. So,
Lord.
Corey, who would you say is your favorite, like, contemporary horror filmmaker at this point? Like, who still makes films?
I'm blanking right now. Who did Hereditary and Midsommar?
Blanking.
Those were interesting, terrifying films. I don't know. Some people saw Hereditary and they didn't see anything.
Ari Aster?
Is that right?
Okay. Yeah, Ari Aster. Yeah.
I saw Hereditary, and I mean, it was one of the only movies that I was on tour, and I just saw it in the middle of the day, and the rest of my day was fucked. I just, everything seemed off. Like, everybody seemed off.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was, I carried that one out of the theater with me, and there's still some scenes in there that if I think about it enough, I can get, you know, the hair on my neck stand up.
I see a little kid in it. Did that fuck you up extra?
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's, that, you know, being a father, maybe that did it. There are certain movies that I know not to watch, you know.
Right.
And there's certain kinds of stuff that I don't at all get into. I can't stand any of that Saw torture porn stuff. That's not
your style.
Yeah, I know. And then the sexism and stuff like that from the 80s stuff can be taken and put over here. You know, I can get my brain around that. But the like violence against women stuff, that stuff is, that's always, I mean, even on like, when I first, my wife, you know, after we were married, she'd be watching, what is it? NCIS is the one or something. And I came in, I was like, so a woman is harmed or murdered at the beginning 3 minutes of every one of these shows. and she's like, well, sometimes it's a man. But it triggers a, you know, a gut. I've always had my emotions tied to my stomach. You know, if something goes wrong, if I'm mourning, someone dies, it's I want to vomit.
Yeah.
And so like those kind of things trigger a nausea with me, and I can't watch them. No matter how high art it is, you know, it could be irreversible, that film. I could throw up thinking about it when I watched it. Like Straw Dogs or something. You know, I can't fuck with that stuff. And so, you know, I have to carefully read the descriptions, you know, like I'm picking
out. Are you kind of like empathic, where you feel like sometimes it feels like a little too real and you can't separate it?
Maybe. Yeah. I'm not sure what it is. Something primal. It's something, you know, right down in there. But then, you know, like I can watch Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're exploitive, but also, you know, like there's always like a kick-ass surviving woman in those, you know.
And they're kind of like far enough removed from like a real reality where you can actually enjoy it, right?
Hell. Yeah. Even something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which has its dabblings in reality, is also stylized enough. You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I don't know if you went through this on tour, but when you brought up Hereditary, I had like maybe 2 summers ago, I'm touring with Mercy Union. I'm like a few weeks in, I hadn't seen my kids in too long, you know? And they took me to see, I'm in one of those moods. Someone gave me like an edible. They're like, yeah, we're going to the movies. I'm like, fuck it. Go to the movies. I don't care. Pick a movie. Like, you know, I was being Mr. Easy Town. And they're like, oh, let's go see the new Pet Sematary. And I'm like, all right. You know, not my usual style of how I would choose to enjoy 2 hours. You know, I'd prefer a comedy or something, but okay, if this is what everyone says. And of course, the one time I try to be cool, I go into this theater and like right into it, there's just like child death, child ghosts, like, you know, just children being put through the paranormal ringer. I couldn't handle it. I was like, I missed my kids too much. It made me nervous. Like that something was happening at home and the movie was like prophetic, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, after having kids, man, I have to like be really careful about what I would watch when I would travel. I would, even just getting on the plane, leaving, watching a film on the plane that is like too intense. I'm just like, oh God, I'm so depressed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, oh, Minority Report used to be fun. Oh no, his kid's missing. Oh God, this movie sucks.
Yeah. It really fucks you up, man.
All right. So, Corey, that being said, right, I've been having a fun question that's been happening in here, and I want to give it to you.
Yeah, say, we need some fun all of a sudden, yeah?
Oh, yeah. We need fun. Say Ari Aster drops into your DMs tomorrow, right?
Okay.
And they're like, slides into your DMs, excuse me, if there's anyone under like 35 listening to this. Slides into your DMs is like, listen, I was listening to Going Off Track. You seem to have a real keen observational knowledge for horror films. here's a boatload of money. Give up singing for like 6 months and you get to make like a horror film of your choice. You know, you can any period, any cast, any plot. You got any ideas where you would go with that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, they say write what you know. It would obviously be a, you know, a touring acoustic folk musician horror movie. And I would rely a lot on practical effects. No CGI. All okay. About blood squibs. And you know, I'd see what Savini's up to. If we got enough money, I would get Savini to do the gore. There would be a lot of gore. It would mostly center around the green rooms of various punk rock dives around the country. you know, maybe something crawls out from the stickers behind that are holding the walls up of these infrastructures.
The penises on the walls come alive.
Every penis comes alive. All the bad graffiti is like prophecy.
Yeah, right.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Oh, this is way too easy, you know, and there's always the sound guy turns. I mean, that's, you know, he's already disgruntled anyway. I mean, just
wait, but
right
are you
there,
are
right
you
there.
Murdering? Are you murdering in this story? Or are you in a fear of being murdered?
Well, it wouldn't be me. I would have to recast it, obviously.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I would be the protagonist would be just the musician.
Okay.
Just easier. You know, I like to see myself as a hero in my own story. Yeah, I mean, there's so much. I mean, you know, and then whether, say, like in Day of the Dead, you know, with Bub, the zombie that they're trying to sort of recondition to be human. I think there's a lot of potential there for, you know, if I have a drummer in my band. That was for you, Benny. And you know, when they're
programming these days, it's kind of only half a joke.
When they're flying from town to town, you know, to see if any of the towns are, you know, not destroyed, you know, that could be
right.
Like when you're passing through Des Moines.
Yeah.
You know, on your way.
You're like, is anyone here?
Des Moines. Yeah. Yeah. No one's going to come to this gig in the streets. Or just, yeah. I could totally see it.
So, all right. So who are you, out of all of our friends or people we know, who are you casting as this protagonist?
Oh, interesting. Probably Jenny.
Jimmy who?
Jenny.
Oh, cool.
I think she'd be like a kick-ass.
That's an interesting take. Now, would you have like a comedic element, like a comedic side element?
Oh God, yeah. It's gotta be like a kitsch sort of you know, Evil Dead 2 kind of thing. Yeah, it can't be, you know, it can't be like, I'm not going to do Cronenberg body horror. even though there's some, you know, I love that stuff. God, I just watched Videodrome again the other night. When he sticks that gun into the faux vagina that opens up in his belly, there's some, I mean, that's some stuff. That's what's going on right there. Have you watched that one in a while?
I haven't. I got to be honest. I got to come clean, Corey. I even texted Brad before this interview saying, hey, are you into horror movies? Because I don't really watch them much. And Corey's really into it. And Brad wrote back, nope.
Yeah.
So yeah, I knew you were really into it.
I'll give you a list.
Yeah, it would be fun to talk.
It's more of a, yeah. I don't, you know, I'm not like a Tarantino with this stuff. I don't know, you know, the grip's wife's name, you know, of a particular movie. But I just grew up with it. Like, yeah. I grew up in, you know, Mississippi in a pretty religious household. But for some reason, they were kind of like chill about pop culture stuff. My old man he was a jet mechanic. So we'd go to the little dirt mall every once in a while. And I remember him being like, what do you want to see? You want to see Scarface? You want to see, what was the other one that was showing? Dirty Harry, maybe was showing. But, you know, he would just take me to all this crazy stuff. But we had, I mean, they were the kind of parents that didn't care that I was glued to MTV and stuff, you know, whereas, you know, all the other parents in the church were like, it's the devil. and then my aunt and uncle in Mississippi, they owned a movie store. And so when I stayed with them, they were just like, yeah, whatever, you know, get whatever Betamax you want to watch. And so I was like, you know, Seven and popping The Shining on, and like,
just paint us a picture. Like, paint me a picture. What a. I'm imagining this is the 80s. Like, what is a little mom and pop video store in northern Mississippi? Like, what's the vibe of that place?
You know, it was a furniture store. Let's see. They had all the videos. You know, it's just it was. Blockbuster had their thing, and it was all, you know, little black boxes and stuff. These, my aunt and uncle would have the actual promo boxes out. And so you could go and look at all the ridiculous art, you know.
You're like, right. Oh,
I spat on a grave, you know. So, you know, The Howling, you know, and all these things. I don't know. I was just a screwed up little kid, and I was just like, hey, this is, I shouldn't be watching this. This is fantastic. And then, you know, you go to the little local pharmacy, and on the rack there, I was like, what's Fangoria magazine? And I was flipping through it. I'm like, oh, wow. Someone's head is eating someone's neck, is eating someone's leg. This is perfect. This is me. This is for me. They made this magazine just from, I don't know who else is going to buy this magazine. This is for me. And, yeah, I just was into it. And then later on, funnily enough, we moved, like four streets over, like you do in Mississippi. and then it was a big, big move.
Right.
We had a fireplace. then, to use, you know, for the 3 days of winter we get. But our neighbor owned a video store in South Haven, and it was a horror video store. His specialty was horror, and like all the old school. So like, he schooled me on the old school stuff. He's like, oh, you don't know this. And so, but he also had a horror room in his house that had all the kits and all the, you know, the collectible stuff, the old school stuff. And so, yeah, I don't know. I loved that stuff. And then I didn't care about it forever. You know, once I picked up a guitar and picked up a girl, I never really looked back at that stuff. And I didn't watch any horror, you know, through the 90s and in any of that stuff.
But did it tie kind of into like your interest in like metal?
Well, you know, like obviously the Cannibal Corpse and stuff like that, and Napalm Death and things like that. But for me, music was always, kind of scattershot, you know, in Mississippi, it's, you just get what you get. You know, there were no punks. Nobody exactly identified. And maybe if you did, it would be hair metal or something.
Right.
But the hood rat down the street that I was explicitly supposed to stay away from, the obviously jail bound, you know, Mike Judge type character,
Sean, who ended up in jail. Then my parents were right about, you were right, guys. You were right. He ended up
in jail. Yeah, they nailed it.
Yeah, so I would immediately make a beeline for him. And he was the first one that gave me, here's Gang of Four, but here's also Napalm Death, and here's also, here's Eazy-E, you know. And it was just like this, throwing shit at the wall, and it was like, what, my parents would hate all of this. I love it, you know, whatever.
I
just would get whatever I could.
Where are you even getting those records? Did you have a record store?
No. Well, yes, I didn't know about it yet. I went to work at it later. The old school one in Memphis was Pop Tunes. It's been around forever.
Yeah.
And they had four or five locations. I ended up working at the one on this is so Mississippi sounding, on Bullfrog Corner. I know. It just sounds like we were just all loading up in the car like the Beverly Hillbillies and going to work.
Of course it was on Bullfrog Corner.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was great. It was a real malfunction junction area there because the lights were, I don't know, so fucked up. And so you get to work, and then every, you know, two, three times a day, there'd just be a car wreck out in front of the place.
Right.
The lights are all fucked up. But that was a good job. We were one of the last ones that had all the 45s for the jukeboxes, the old school jukeboxes that still use those. And so, and just kicking myself to this day for not buying up all those old blues and R&B and soul.
Oh, right.
45s. Yeah. It had all the stuff. And it was just, you know, it wasn't that prized back then, you know, in the early 90s.
Sure.
And I'd have to sort that stuff. And I missed opportunity there.
Hmm. What was your like relationship with the church as you were getting a little older, and if and why you were moving away from it? Like, was that okay with your parents and your family?
Probably not. I grew up going, like, you know, 8 days a week, it felt like. Uh-huh. You know, you do the Wednesday and you do the two Sundays. And, you know, and it's a Southern Baptist kind of, you know, almost like Iron Man triathlon kind of services, you know.
Right.
So I grew up with that. Not particularly a believer, but just, you know, how you do, social. Right. And then, you know, when I got to call the shots as I got a little older, I just, you know, it wasn't like full on, you know, exorcist, fuck God kind of thing. But it was let's just cut this down to once on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And then later I was just like, you know, guys, this is not my thing. They were okay about it. It's just kind of one of those things you don't talk about, you know, until later, you know, after high school and stuff. But, but there are things, it's just so fucked. I mean, it's so fucked. And I have a personal, you know, I'm not just atheist. I'm evangelical atheist. You know, I'm.
Oh wow!
Very against it.
Is there anything like acute that kind of led to that, or is just like over time?
Over time, realizing what a number it did on my head. You know, it's just I was a relatively imaginative kid. I had a
right.
You know, a whole little universe going on in my head, and to describe in graphic, almost Catholic detail about what a crucifixion is, and then the, you know, the weight on the lungs and these sorts of things. You know, I just ran with that, and I ran with, you know, this idea that I was flawed fundamentally, and these sorts of things, and it just, I mean, it doesn't. I'll find it creeping up, you know. I'm 46. Right. I think I'm 46. I can't remember anymore.
If you messed up your son's age, you got to fuck up your own. It's
right.
That'll get you out of the first one.
Oh yeah, yeah.
it's like I don't know anyone, so I don't even know mine.
that's a good cover. But it's true. I've been saying I was 46, 47 for a while. My wife's like, you're 45. Don't rush it. and 'cause she's younger.
But
there are things that I'll give credit where credit's due. This was a relatively
apolitical church. This was before this being, I mean, obviously the whole thing that unified the evangelicals and the Southern Baptists was like abortion at this time.
Right.
Because it couldn't be civil rights anymore, you know.
Right.
They were like, okay, well, we can't be playing that card anymore. So they had all their meetings from the head, and they're like, we're going to make this, because before, if you go back, the church is like, that's government issue, yeah, whatever.
Right.
And then so they used that as the rallying cry.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
But my church was relatively apolitical, but yeah. Oh yeah, you can go back and look up the Southern Baptist conventions, and you can see the year it shifted, when they're like, this is going to be the focus.
Yeah. What was that? Like 70s, 80s, so you think, when that kind of made that turn?
70s.
Yeah.
It's in the 70s. I'll send you a link. There's this really good piece on it. I don't know. I've got a link. I'll send you later.
So basically had to rally the troops under a new flag, right?
Well, under some way that they can maintain a political leverage. And so, they had to find some sort of knee-jerk thing, they're like, killing kids. They're killing kids, So, I don't like dead kids.
Sure, yeah, like, sure.
This is a great thing. It's a blanket thing. It'll be great.
Yeah, right.
It's so fucked. All that being said, there are things that going to a fundamental church that was apolitical benefited me, and I will give it this. They read from the Bible. There were sermons expounding upon whatever they're reading, but there was a lot of verbatim reading, and so not being exposed to a lot of poetry as a child, I think a lot of my ear for rhetorical things like parallelism and the repetition of a word, creating power over time. I got a lot of these sort of literary things in my ear, I think, from just the reading of the King James Bible. So I will give it that. I will give it some of the music was good. Some of the Southern, the Southern Baptist gospel music. It wasn't any of that, just awful. If there was a God, that it would totally offend him. Kind of worship music that Jesus. it wasn't the real dry Presbyterian. Is Presbyterian the dry one? I don't know. but I mean, we weren't handling snakes or nothing. But it got a little funky in there. And so some of the music was good. I don't know. Star and a half. I won't give it 2 stars.
I love that you got your rap. You got your rap from Jesus, basically.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
A little bit of my flow.
Yeah.
probably from the Church of England, or the translation. Of
right, sure. By the time you got to it, yeah.
I don't know if it had the same flow. And
you got the King James rap. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you doing for, Brad and I are both raising kids like you. What are you doing for religion in your house? And how are you presenting spirituality like in general?
Well, I'm letting my wife handle it.
me too.
Yeah.
You lucky bastards.
Which is pretty much my answer for anything. My child, my boy, I have a daughter. She's a couple years older, and she's in Tulsa. And so she's being raised religious. Her mother's religious.
Okay.
And since I'm not on the scene anywhere as much as I would like to be, that's her call.
Okay.
Now, when my daughter asked me, I'm not going to lie.
And you're not going to push it. You're going to let it come to you.
Yes, absolutely. I wouldn't.
Sure.
And I don't push. I won't push with my son. He's going to be like, is there a God? I'm like, well, there are stories about lots of gods. I mean, he knows all the Greek stories, and he knows about Jesus, and he knows about Buddha, and he knows these stories. And I'm like, and there's a lot of wisdom in a lot of these stories. And there are a lot of decent people that find meaning in life, with these things. I'm like, I will respect some of these things, you know, I'll give this its due, but I'm also not going to bullshit the kid.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So he has a thing sometimes about magic and stuff. He's like, well, you know, this, these animals can change their sex, or this is something this octopus does to survive in this. And he's like, that's magical. And I'm like, you were right. That yeah. is magic. That is magical. But then sometimes he's about ghosts and I'm like, well, that's not a thing.
Right. So this thing is magical. Like, that doesn't exist. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a, right. he's like, well, I mean, you, he's like, you don't know. He's like, we can't know. I'm like, and that's right. We can't know. And I'm like, yeah. But when 99.9% of empirical evidence is against it, I'm like, I'm going to bet that hand. I'm just like, I'm just a betting man. And I mean, you know, and so, I'm leaning towards empirical evidence with him. But again, I'm not going to try to steer him, too far. Just sure. He just happens to ask about a lot of things. And I'm like, here's what I think.
All right. Well, speaking of the pious, I wanted to talk about a man, actually, that I just heard about. Someone who's kind of a sad story, but a man named Tampa Bloom, the less successful younger brother of Orlando Bloom.
Oh, I try to talk John out of these things. He's referring to a John Snodgrass song about Tampa Bloom.
Yeah.
Which is actually one of his more successful stoner ideas.
So how did you get lured into this, the Bloom song scenario?
Well, John and I tour a lot. And
yeah.
So, and John gets high a lot. And John has epiphanies. He records his epiphanies into his phone. A lot of times I'll get a voicemail from John when I'm off the road, and I'm like, oh, I check it, and it's just him singing the worst, the worst, you know, greatest stroke of genius. I don't know. Who am I to say? He uses me to bounce things off of, and I love the man. Lord, he's got some stoner ideas. I love John, and he's a funny dude. You know him.
Yeah.
He's really funny, but what he'll do a lot of times is have a in joke, and then he'll make a side joke off of that in joke, and then he'll write a parody of that side joke into a song. And I'm like, John, no one's going to know. I'm like, I was there when it happened. I've got the voicemail, and I don't fucking know what you're talking about. Right.
It's a little too deep.
Oh, I love the man. He's great.
What's like a highlight of the person Tampa Bloom? What are they like? And like, do you remember any lyrics from this track?
He's probably like the Luke Wilson, you know. I don't know if that's fair to Luke. Luke's had some good movies.
Yeah, he's better, right? Yeah.
Maybe he's like Billy Baldwin. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's more fair. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Or Eric Roberts.
Maybe he's trying to like raise Emu or something. You know, he's got a plan always. He's got some sort of thing in the works. He's going around to collect money somebody owes him.
Yeah.
He's that guy. I think. I don't know. Again, this is John's world. You'd have to ask him.
Yeah, yeah.
When he fleshes out his characters.
And just, to stay, yeah. I mean, to stay on point with what you were talking about John Snodgrass, this came up because I was attempting to get a mystery friend question, which obviously this can't work for that.
No. You know when John's asking a question.
But even in like the 15 minutes of getting what this Tampa Bloom song is about, a couple side characters started. Another older brother who lives in Europe called St. Augustine Bloom. And then a sister, a long-lost sister called Sarasota Bloom.
He likes characters based on towns or places.
Only in Florida. Yeah.
He's a pun guy. He's yeah, John is one of my favorite people in the world, and he's really fun to tour with in Europe because he just sort of thinks everybody's like on the same page.
And
and when you're in a French McDonald's,
everyone is not on the same page. No.
They're not on the same page when you're ordering
when you're pointing at the menu and saying dies,
yeah,
and
yeah,
dos. Yeah. I mean, and he's like, I want this and I want two of those. He's using a Spanish word to order two, you know. He's amazing. He's like a human shuffle button. Yeah. You know, it's just like if you go to your movies or you go to your music and you just hit shuffle. That's John. I love it. He's got a lot of things going on.
That French thing is important you talk about. I've obviously been in that situation many times. And if you don't have a cooler with you, it can get hot, especially where you're from. Like, I remember one of the first times I was in France and it wasn't a fast food, but it was like a side highway thing. And it was just some old man who wouldn't stop fucking staring at us. And, you know, I'm not from France. I'm sorry. I'm from around New York City. If someone's just locking you for that long, like they fucking got something to say, you know? And yeah, like
Tim Barry would call it, he was gritting on you.
Yeah, exactly. And I like, you know, some of the people I was with was like, Benny, like this old fucking man. I'm like, I don't give a shit. Like, he probably killed people in the 40s. I don't know. Like, yeah, yeah.
Probably so watching Nazi exploitation.
Like, John's kind of was like the Gaslight World. It was kind of the Ian Perkins, you know? It's like just the guy you can bring somewhere who's like going to get along with everyone regardless.
I can totally see that. I can see that about Ian.
Yeah, he's a great cooler. But anyway, so John, as good of a guy as he is, completely failed as a mystery friend because... Yeah. Obviously, he wrote the song he's talking about, so there's no mystery.
Did he finish it? Because usually they're a verse and a chorus.
I'm not sure. I think that's why he's such a successful jingle writer now, baby.
I think we still have... we have to finish Friend of the Dancer, which is about...
he brought that up. Actually. Yeah, and what's that song about?
Oh, man. Oh God, I'm up too early. Come on.
Was it John Gaunt being a great dancer?
It's
was
about
that it?
Gaunt, and I'm trying to think of the situation when it first occurred. But Gaunt's got moves. I don't know if you've ever seen him dance.
I found out last night that John Gaunt's got moves. It's very surprising. It's like it's like a Spike Jonze video playing out in my head. Like
It's great. And so when you first see it, it's a disconnect. It's great. I mean, John had the idea of, you know, like, basically just he wanted to write a song about being a supportive friend or whatever, just being a happy to be a wingman, kind of, you know. It's like, we're just friends of the dancer. It's like, no, we're not gonna go dance with you. We're friends of the dancer here. which is very John idea and but potential for a really sweet song. I'm not sure how far he's gotten on it.
There's a pop hook waiting there. All right, so let's get to the real mystery friend. So since John failed me, I had to go for another one.
Okay.
Now, this instant, do you know the... I'm sorry, I didn't even... Do you know the game, Mystery Friend?
I don't.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to prompt you on a little bit of a story. I'd like you to give me the details of this story and then guess which one of your mystery friends told me.
Okay.
Now, I heard about this. It was... nearing the end of a tour in 2011, and apparently you stay at someone from Lucero's house towards the end of the tour. Now, the quote I got from the person is they walked into this house, and in quotes, "I've never met anyone more immersed in the magic of Christmas." There was a mountain of gifts, and they were shocked to find out he had only one child. Because apparently it was like a winter Christmas wonderland. Do you remember this?
Okay, yeah. This is sounding familiar. This might not be the exact game for me because everything before this sentence is kind of a blur with my life. I just have these little passing cars of memories. I'm like, wait. But this is ringing a bell. That sounds like Venable's house.
Mm-hmm.
So who would I have been with? 2011. Oh God, that was pre-Mutt.
Well, tell me about this house a little. Like, what was going on there to make this person tell me it was like the North Pole?
I mean, it might have just been the associative properties of Brian Venable and his big beard.
I've just been like, well, Santa Claus is on the couch. It might have took more, nothing more than that. There might not even been a tree. It might have just been Brian Venable's beard there. And they're like, this is the most Christmas thing I've ever seen. Yeah, I think he'd gone all out. If I'm remembering this correctly, it's just a stack of gifts. It's just a, you know.
You were on tour with the person who told me this story.
I bet this is Dave Haas.
This is Dave Haas. Yeah. And it makes a little more sense now. The idea that, like, Dave thought he walked into some Christmas wonderland, and I don't think you really noticed that much, which seems like pretty normal.
Yeah, maybe Dave Haas just had a really bleak upbringing that we're not. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Now I'm picturing like this guy Brian at a totally normal house, and Dave just had like one
piece like, of like
crinky like foot and a half fake pine. With like just some scratchy lotto tickets like underneath or something. like was it that bad for him?
Some empty liquor bottles hanging from the tree.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it was a bleak situation.
There's an eighth of I don't know. All right.
That was the first, I think that was the time I met him. We just rented a Taurus and said hello and then went out on the road for a month together. I think one of the gigs was canceled because of a gas leak, but we played it anyway.
Oh, shit.
Again, that might be why I don't remember before this sentence. You'd have to ask him about the specifics of that one.
Okay.
But yeah, it's, I vaguely remember who Dave now, is. My brain is so bad. I love the man.
You're like a goldfish. Perfect for a podcast, Corey.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Just you could ask me the questions you already asked me if you want.
All right, I'm going to ask you something a little more pointed because it's something I need to ask you. Shoot. Do you ever sit back in your robe, preferably, and, you know, put your head into your arms and go, you know, I'm sick of being everybody's favorite guitar player. Someone give me some fucking money.
I'm not sure what that means. Everybody's favorite guitar player.
You are. I know you can't say it because you're from Northern Mississippi and you got a nice vibe about you. You always have.
Also because I'm like literally maybe the 50th best guitar player that I know. Like I mean, you know, I've been doing it a long time, so I know a lot of cutthroats. I mean, I know guys that have their own signature models of.
Oh, but that doesn't mean anything.
They don't just give those out.
They do. You know the way the deal works. Why? All right, listen. Why did I, the same drummer I'd always been, inexplicably start getting endorsements when my band got really big?
Oh yeah, no, I know, like, I know that. That's the whole celebrity thing too. Of like, you
it's
know,
not it's like I just got really good real fast. You know? Like,
yeah. I know how that works. Yeah. But no. I mean, I know. Some really, really good guitar players. I know, you know, I mean, like I grew up around Luther Dickinson, for fuck's sake, you know, he's the greatest slide guitar player in the world. He played on a Replacements record when he was 11.
Whoa.
Like his brother, because Jim produced Pleased to Meet Me and Luther was already amazing. But that Shooting Dirty Pool song is like not really a song. It was almost a collage that Jim made of outtakes and things. And there's the whole fight scene in there. And all the noise guitar, that's Luther at 11. And his brother still messes with him about it. He's like, because he's doing the siren sound. And his brother Cody's like, you finger tapped on a Replacements record. But
I'm a huge Replacements fan. I never knew that little detail.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. Those stories. Oh. And like, you know, that was done at Arden, obviously. And, man, there's all kind of crazy stories from that. You know, and they came, obviously, because Jim had worked with Big Star. And they were huge fan. This is the song Alex Chilton, you know. There's a long history of, you know, it's Memphis. And I was born here and, you know, grew up in Mississippi just because there were no hospitals where I was from when I was born. So they had to drive up and have me and drive back home. But then I moved after high school to the big city of Memphis. And, you know, it's one of those places, you know, Benny, where are you from? Are you Jersey, like, originally? I don't know.
I'm from, like, about 30 minutes west of Manhattan. Like, that's, grew up, been here the whole time.
And so, you know, there's, like, this legacy of music to be from a music place, you know?
Sure.
And obviously Memphis is broader than some things that did one thing specifically. But, yeah, it's just crazy, you know? And then when you get into it and start playing and being, you know, being a professional, and then working in Arden and things like that, and you hear all this history and you walk through the halls and you're like, shit, Trace Ombres was made here, and all right. these things, you know, and I don't know, it's just something, it's daunting, obviously, but there's, I'm always interested in music towns and what's happened to them, because they can, in some respects, be ghost towns for the things that they the trails they blazed. You know, not a lot of good rockabilly in Memphis, not a lot of good power pop. You know, not a lot of things that it's known for. There's still good R&B and soul, a lot of good hip hop. Memphis not known for that. This is obviously known for soul, but I don't know. It's just always interesting to me how a town either appreciates its musical legacy, how it whores it out for tourist time.
Nashville.
But that's always, just coming from a place like this has always been interesting to me.
I mean, was that hard for you? Like, because, you know, as you're talking about, there's just, like, it's Memphis and there's these great guitar players all over, great singers all over. And, you know, obviously the town of what, like Otis Redding and Isaac Hayes and, you know, Muddy Waters, like, I don't know, just the list goes on. And you kind of, I didn't know this actually until doing research on you, but, like, you know, it seems like you sort of went from, you know, metal and whatever bands you could find, and then discovered John Prine and some of the, you know, related artists with that, and kind of switched over and sort of quickly got a lot of recognition for it. Like, is, you know, when you were making that switch in a town like Memphis, is that really daunting when you have this great history and all these people around?
No, I took it for granted back then when I was playing, you know, I started playing guitar at 13 and playing in, you know, metal bands and death metal bands and black metal bands, whatever, whoever had me. And then I played in country bands with my, you know, metal guitars. Just whoever would have me as a guitar player, I would play. It didn't faze me until later. When I became more of a student, you know, like of where I'm from, and some of it seeps into you, you know, through the church and through things you're exposed to. And then there's the whole, you know, it's the Mississippi thing too. And, you know, Muddy was actually from Mississippi. He's Issaquena County, I think. You know, there's that whole thing. I mean, again, a lot of that is just this area. There's a thing with Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Memphis, because all the people that, a lot of people, you know, Elvis was a Mississippi boy. Johnny Cash was from Arkansas. Jerry Lee was from Louisiana. Mm-hmm. It's just this sort of, you know, these things that can develop in still water in isolation, you know.
Sure.
I sort of hip myself slowly to that. And so I would think it was more daunting as a songwriter later on, when I had a fucking clue about the world.
Right.
But the benefits of it outweigh any sort of anxiety of influence. I believe Harold Bloom would put it like that.
Huh.
Did
it have anything to do with, like kind of the seriousness of the things that, like, happened in that town? And I'm just talking, like, off my head here, but, you know, if there's, you know, two things Memphis is known for someone from where I'm from, it's music and it's what happened.
Assassination of Martin Luther King.
That and just the civil rights movement in general. I mean, there's, you know, obviously the assassination's a big part of it, but Memphis was an epicenter of people and movements that happened throughout, you know, the entire century, really. So, Do you think that's part of what comes out of there? It's like, it's like we're not fucking around. This is like a serious town because serious stuff has happened here.
Yeah. I mean, there's Memphis was, predominantly, a progressive, downtown was largely black owned businesses. And then, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in the subsequent garbage riots. It's a city that never recovered from that. You know, the psyche of the city, you know, obviously economically it's gone up and down and things like that. But, there's a thing about the area. I think this is just me. I don't know. I'm no historian. But you have like, say when you're in a city, like the Randy Newman song, Good Old Boys or whatever. It's like, well, yeah, you set people free to put them in a cage in Harlem, to put them in a cage in South San Francisco, to put them in a cage, you know.
Right.
But it's not like that here because you have such poor black, poor white, and the communities are more intermingled than that. You had obviously these horrible racial clashes and this terrible history, but there was also a bit of melding that went on with the churches and the schools and things. Mm. You know, my school was half black, half white. It's your neighbors and your community. And so, right. I don't know. And I don't want to get too hippy dippy about it because it's,
oh, please do. You're talking to me.
Well, I mean,
come on.
There's something there. There's something worthwhile there, but there's obviously, just huge, huge, problems with, you know, I'm not, equipped to talk about the problems of this country, what the country was founded on, and they're here today. And
yeah, I mean, because, you're in a robe, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, just because people are, just because people have mostly agreed not to say overtly racist things in public, you know, make this not a racist.
No, of course.
It's a fucking mess. The town's a mess. America's a mess. Whatever. Let's talk about something that I'm equipped to talk about.
Well, No, it's interesting. It's really interesting you say all that. Like that's one of the biggest things I noticed when I started touring was just that I hadn't realized, you know, even though in, you know, you'll go to cities down south or in the Midwest and, you know, I'm accustomed to lower class living, looking like the Bronx, looking like Harlem, looking like giant buildings into the sky. Oh, yeah. And, you know, you go down south and you're like, oh, it's just like nice little ranch houses, you know, this is fine. And then you realize, you know, the poverty is so, so ingrained to that part too. But one thing that's stunning is like, it becomes clear really fast that in the Northeast, we do not live together. I mean, that's just the simple nature of how things were broken up here. And
out of necessity, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not equipped to tell
you why. Hasidic Jewish community, you have an Italian community or something like that. With a lot of immigrants in New York specifically flooding in, like at a certain time, they stuck together out of necessity and made a strong community. And so some of it, that's where, you know, again, that's where I'm not a historian. I don't know how to delineate where that ends and where it's forced upon people, you know.
But that was a big misconception I had when I first went down south and kind of got a quick lesson. And I wanted to ask you, what is the biggest misconception that a northerner who's like never traveled down to where you're from has that's completely false?
Ignorant levels of education. I think they're all expecting the clampets, you know, or some sort of right. variation of the clamp, an extension of that, maybe the inverse of it, but they're expecting this sort of warmness, this sort of gentility. Mm. This sort of southern thing that was a holdover You know, some of the South hung on to European mannerisms, right? Especially in Louisiana, you know, things like this. But they hung on to some of that aristocratic thing. It's just window dressing, you know, and it's people are not inherently more polite or any of these sorts of things. It's just the you extend this sort of face. There's a lot of almost maybe like in Japanese culture about saving face and
right.
This sort of ritualistic respect you extend, but it's just, it's for show. People yeah. here suck like they suck everywhere, you know, right. that thing.
Yeah.
And so you have people that think it's all, you know, like the hills have eyes, and then you have people that think it's all fucking,
yeah, like whatever, like some, you know, Savannah cotillion or something. Yeah.
Exactly. And right. neither of those things are exactly true. There are elements of them.
Yeah. That's funny. Well, do you, you know, going back on like a lot of your lyrics, you know, I'm listening to a lot of your music before this. They're great, man. They're great. Do you consider yourself like a satirist?
No, I'm not particularly good at that. You know, I'm not, I have a streak of it. You know, I'm a huge Randy Newman fan.
Yeah.
It's tricky. I dabble. yeah, I do use, it's more out of necessity. I realized, that you can subvert expectations. The quicker you establish a situation, you can start to fuck with it. And I found the quickest way to establish a situation in a song is to work in, cliched form. Like if you hear this song and, you know, two lines in, you're like, oh, this guy meets girl in a bar. This is this kind of song. This is a cheating song, or this is a road song, or this is a whatever. If you have the form in mind, it immediately, you can subvert it. You don't have to take a verse and a chorus and a half of another verse to establish this world. This song already comes fully loaded, the form. And so then I like to fuck with the form. I can do it by the third line. You know,
yeah, interesting.
You know, the image that the metaphor or whatever that I've used before is like a film like Inception, where it's a movie and a movie and a movie. Not a great piece of film, but you know, it's a fun flick. But right. But you know, he's like, oh, we're gonna go in a dream and go in a dream and get this, and you know, it's like, how the hell do you film that, or how do you do it? Well, you make a heist flick,
and
it's like
right.
people immediately sure. know. It's a heist flick. Oh, you can't get there because of all of this. These, you know, these alarms and these things that you already know the format of a heist flick. Mm-hmm. And so he can then go on and do something, you know, depending on your opinion of the movie, something interesting or pretentious with it.
Yeah. Do you need to like take yourself down a peg like early in the song to establish that?
How so?
Like within the first, you know, the first verse or chorus, you almost have to show like a piece of the satire, show like an idea that you're not taking this whole thing too seriously by like one of the lyrics. Like, do you have to do that to make it effective?
I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that a little bit. I know you can achieve a lot through your choice, your word choice. The tone of it. So much steering can be done with the verbs.
Sure.
Yeah. A lot of your intention can be, you know, a wink and a nod with a certain verb, or a juxtaposition of high and low vernacular.
Right.
I mix a lot. And again, that might be a fucking Southern chip on my shoulder about we're not all Jed Clampett. That might be in there somewhere. Huh. I don't know. I don't see a psychiatrist. I should see seven of them. But I, you know, that maybe that's in there, and I'm working with that expectation of, you know,
like Just a touch of literary overcompensation or something?
Oh, maybe, yeah. Oh, I'm sure that's in there. And it's probably in the first drafts more so. You know, I'm sure I'm adept at I can definitely weed out and kill my demon and my little darlings and things like that. But I don't stop myself from those. You know, again, all these sort of things, I just kind of intuit. I just flounder. And I try not to steer too much when I'm doing it. I try to overwrite, you know, for every verse you've heard, I've probably written 3 or 4. And I try to, I'll do it in meter a lot of times because the form will create the content a lot of times. I have words I like and I'm like, oh, what's a good setup for this? Or I usually find that I'm balancing things. I'll have a sweet idea and then the song will end up being just completely nasty to balance that sweet idea, or I'll have things going on and I'm like, I'm doing this too much. What's the opposite? That'll be the bridge. I find that there's always a balancing and a counterbalance of sentiment and jaundiced worldview. There's a lot of balancing I have going on in the songs, and you know, I work at them, you know.
Sure.
I don't know. Yeah.
You ever think you could do like a full, you know, like a full character album, like a, and you know, not, you know, not as racy as maybe Good Old Boys or something like that, but you know, do you think you'd ever do that? And do you think like the world could even handle a record like that these days?
I don't know. But that takes a very certain person to pull off a thing like Good Old Boys.
Yeah.
That's a genius piece of art. I mean, the world could handle being poked in the face. Probably needs it, but I am not that genius. And I also am not good at sustaining themes for longer than a song. They're all sort of more Polaroids than Tolstoy. I can't talk. Tolstoy. Tolstoy. Jesus Christ.
Old Tolstoy.
Old Tolstoy. Yeah, we're on a nickname basis. I've read like 2 of his books. It's that what Randy Newman does there, and he does, he's particularly good at baiting. I mean, in that album, he baits Northerners and Southerners, you know, and
sure.
He's baiting you in Good Old Boys as a Northerner. He's like, you know, oh, the North has set people free. It's like, down here, we're too ignorant to know. He's like, well, yeah, you set them free to live in a cave. The whole song, you know,
right.
is just poking it. And then you have a song like Sail Away that is poking at this Gone with the Wind, Dixieland pastoral vision of magnolias as big as your head. Sail Away. Mm. You know, it's like, and he's painting, you know, this beautiful pastoral picture of the South at sunset. Sail away, sail away. And then you realize he's singing, we'll sail across the ocean into Charleston Bay. He's singing as a slaver to the slaves to get on the ship in Africa.
Right.
So and he's like, he baits the Southerner that wants to think about this, you know, over stylized Gone with the Wind bullshit South without thinking about the blood that is in this soil.
Mm-hmm.
It's a masterwork and it's catchy.
Yeah, right. Like they're actually good songs. Yeah.
But I mean, but the thing is, you know, with Randy Newman, it's like, no, that's high art for me, you know?
Right.
And then he does some pop versions of that when he does like a song like Short People, you know, and you saw, or, you know, or maybe heard, it was way before your time, but people's reaction to that, people were calling in being like, you know, what is this? You can't play this on the radio. This is offensive, you know, against short people. And then all he did in that song was take a random thing and he's spoofing prejudice. He's like, what's a silly thing to be prejudiced about? And he's like, but you know, he gets down in there. He's like with the nasty little fingers and he's like, he's poking the bear.
Yeah.
You
know? Right.
But he's parodying prejudice at its as a thing. But what he's throwing people off is it's catchy, it's pop, and he doesn't exactly wink.
Right.
He doesn't let you off the hook.
Yeah.
And that is a singular artist.
Huh.
There's not a lot of people that can do that. and work in that vein. I mean, that is all his territory. And it's always amazing to me.
Right.
That he's Disney's guy, you know, and it's like,
yeah,
all these,
right. This is the Toy Story guy. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, it's these twisted, you know, these guys that were drawing penises in the old, you know, the old Disney right. things. There's all these subversive artists that actually work for this, you know, monolithic corporation thing.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, let's get Randy Newman. You know? they know his 70s output and it's a genius. And he's just great at writing anything. He can just destroy you. And he's still one of the handful of the old guard that is making a vital, relevant work as good as his stuff. I mean, his last couple, you know, and they're spaced out like 10 years, you know, but that Harps and Angels and then Dark Matter, these records are fantastic.
That's awesome.
Yeah, beautiful things. I'm a huge, huge fan. Yeah. But he's having to pay like the strings on his last record. You know, he's on Nonesuch and stuff, but like, you know, Nonesuch is like, well, we've only got so much money because Randy Newman only sells so many albums, you know. And so Randy Newman goes and pays for his own strings to
so
fully
crazy.
Realize his Whoa. Vision, you know. And it's just like, what's happening with this world? Give Randy Newman a damn orchestra.
We're better off sheetrocking, Corey.
Break off some of that Disney money.
We should have kept sheetrocking. We'd own our own businesses by now, you know.
I'm never going to hang sheetrock again. That is the exact image I put in my head. You know, some people are like, oh, at least I'm not digging a ditch when they're playing like the worst gig, you know. With me, it's like, at least I'm not hanging sheetrock. I'm never doing that again.
Never doing
I couldn't. I'm just a frail, fragile, wilting flower at this point.
Well, you'd certainly have to change.
Wear my robe.
Yeah, you'd certainly have to change.
I just wouldn't want to get any powder or dust on this robe.
I mean, restoration hardware. You do not want sheetrock dust on your restoration hardware robe, Corey. That
hey,
would just be,
you know, Corey, you don't got to be Randy Newman to do the soundtrack to a B movie.
Mm. Now, that's a good point. I have an amazing Prophet Sixth Synth, you know. So a lot of that John Carpenter was on one of these. Oh man, I love those soundtracks. I know that,
no offers yet?
Nobody's called since we've started the podcast, but I don't know. It's probably not going. Oh, actually, that's funny. Jenny Owen Young. I just pulled up my phone. Jenny Owen Young is texting me.
But, you got to text her back and say she's been cast as the protagonist in a new horror film.
That's so funny.
See if she's interested.
I'm not going to.
How much would it cost? Can you pose that question to Jenny right now while we're on the air and see if she answers?
Sure.
Say, so how much would it cost to have you as the lead in my new horror film that I'm producing, directing?
How much would it cost?
This is a Southern man texting right now.
All right, good. Yeah. It's just like, I immediately pictured Foghorn Leghorn. Listen to me when I'm texting you. All set. Sent.
All right. Let's see if we get anything back. Now, speaking of all this, now I wish I had known more, but I really didn't know all that much about John Prine before his passing. I heard it was almost like the sea of, you know, anybody who knew anything about music saying how great this fucking guy was. That
oh man, I wish I could go back and listen to him for the first time.
Yeah, that really sparked. Well, that being said, for someone like me, like, what's a good starter record for John Prine? And what are, let's say, the 3 to 5 like must hear songs like right off the bat?
Yeah, I mean, I would just go with Great Days. It's an anthology that sort of cherry picks the first pre-Fair and Square, you know, the pre-2000s and beyond. Just grab the Great Days anthology. Must listen to songs from me. There's a song called Gold, Stroke of Genius. You got gold inside of you. I got gold, some gold inside me too. It's so simple. It's so beautiful. And it's got these, he just has this droll Midwestern childlike thing going on one hand, you know, where he can say life is a blessing. It's a delicatessen of all the little things that you do. those sort of things. There's that sort of, you know, homespun thing, but then there's a subversive dark thing going on. There's a song like Lake Marie, where it's very beautiful. It's about a dissolution of a marriage. And then it comes to the, there's a part in the bridge where it's like the, they find two strangers mutilated by a lake, and he's like, and their faces have been, messed up with some sharp object. He's like, I saw it on the black and white TV. You know what blood looks like on a black and white TV? Shadows. And then he just yells, shadows. Wow. We were standing by peaceful waters. And that's the chorus comes back. And it's just so like, cool. You're just like, what just happened to me? You know, through this little story. You know, Donald and Lydia is great. Obviously, a song like Sam Stone makes an impression the first time you hear about the heroin-addled post-Vietnam vet. And the line is, there's a hole in daddy's arm where all the money goes. That one does a number on you.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, there, the whole Jesus, the missing years. There's just something mysterious about how his songs work. There's a mischievous nature to him. I don't know. There's a wink in his songs, but you can't figure out. I don't know. There's always something interesting about his stuff to me. It was the first time that I heard simple poetry. It was the first time that I heard something that was deceptively simple like that. To where you could tell there were undercurrents and there was a undertow, you know. And I was just like, oh, I didn't know you could do this with country music.
Right.
Yeah, I was like, oh wait, she's answered back.
Oh.
She says, how about one case of a spicy little microbrewed chocolate peanut butter stout?
Whoa.
One roll. Man, she's got a lot of requests here.
Okay, and there's more. All right.
She might be. One roll for Frank the dog. And she's got to be the last girl standing and not allowed to die, which is absolutely, like I was saying earlier, that's it for me. You got to have the strong survivor.
All right.
She said, cool. Wow. A musical horror movie. I am all caps ready.
Wow. There you go, Corey. Yeah. Here you go. You've been looking for things to do, huh? Reasons to take the robe off in the morning. Oh, you're welcome.
I might direct with the robe on. this is coming together real fast.
It's awesome, man.
Green lit.
Done. I'll throw a couple shekels into the mix if you want. What does she need? I'll take care of the first part. What was that? What did she need?
Just a case of microbrewed chocolate peanut butter stout, which frankly, it sounds like a horror movie in its own.
Yeah.
That's just me personally.
Yeah, I'm not into that.
Why don't you throw some jelly into that?
Yeah, what's my dessert doing in a bottle? No thanks.
I don't like my food to taste like other food.
No. The one last question that I have to ask for all the yearning Corey Brannon fans out there.
Hi, Mom.
Is you've been talking for like 2 years about having, you know, like 1,500 songs or whatever you have, a lot. When's an album going to come out?
Man, I don't know. I'm between labels, so who knows?
Okay.
I don't have that many. I did have a good year the year before last. Wrote a lot. They just tend to stack up. You know, it takes so long between records. You know the business.
I do.
So I just want to find, blue collar working man's label that can keep me in product, and that's what they say they're gonna do, which I don't think they exist anymore. I don't know, we'll see.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
People are like, yeah, just self-release it. I'm like, yeah, I don't want seven more jobs that don't pay, you know. I'm about to I'm about to direct a horror movie. I'm about to be busy.
I can't distribute an album. I got Jenny Owens Young to worry about. Yeah.
I got to get the sheetrock up.
Oh, Corey Brannon.
Thank you for soothing my soul for an hour and a half.
I know. I could just listen to him talk. I feel bad anytime I get into like a real deep conversation with someone from the proper South. Cause it's like, you're one of my like six resources to get real answers for things that I need to know. Right. And I know he's like token Southern guy all the time to like, you know, people like me, and he has to like answer his question. But I need to know. It's fascinating. You know, the guy's from Northern Mississippi. Like, if I didn't start playing music and touring, like, would have I ever become friends with somebody from Northern Mississippi and been able to get their insight, you know? So
real deal.
This is why I just got in an argument with somebody that I respect a lot, but they were basically telling me that the fact that I have very little education and almost all anecdotal evidence means my point doesn't mean as much. And you know what? I don't agree, because I get to talk to guys like Corey Brandon,
yeah,
and pick their brains, you know, like I get to go to the meat of the situation. Sure, I didn't read empirical evidence about what he's talking about. I don't want to. I mean, maybe I'll bruise over it, you know, but I don't know.
You're getting firsthand information.
So I'm saying I didn't go to 49 of 50 of these states, usually in an awful, awful conditions to, you know, just to be sidetracked as someone who knows nothing, you know, I know something. I've seen some shit, right? Yeah. You don't need a college degree for that.
Hell no.
I know. I'm feeling self-conscious about not graduating college. I can't take algebra again, Brad. Ugh. Gross. Gross. Anyway.
If you're from the South, you probably like hot sauce.
Yeah, I would imagine. These episodes.
Buy some fucking hot sauce.
Yeah, are in conjunction with Silk City Hot Sauce. And if you go to silkcityhotsauce.com and use the promotional code GOT, you get a free bottle of hot sauce, 15% off, cool stickers. The stuff's really good.
It is.
They have a variety of different flavors. It's all locally grown peppers in southern Vermont. No funny business, no weird chemicals, all good organic ingredients, good taste. Cook it with anything. And then all the covers are this really badass, like rock and roll pulp art. Can even put them on, like, you know, if you have one of those man caves with like a pool table and you're trying to hold on to your youth.
Yeah.
You know, this hot sauce would be perfect on those mantles. You know,
it's comic book artists that do the covers and they're really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you got one of those rooms with those weird billiards lights and some shelving, you don't even need to eat this stuff. You could just put it up as art.
Yeah. So, you're supporting art, podcasting, and locally grown small batch farmers.
That's right. So silkcityhotsauce.com, GOT is the promo code.
Go check it out.
Ah, that sounds good. And how should we go out here, Brad? Corey Brandon has some socials.
Yeah, you know? Corey Brandon at Twitter, Instagram, CoryBrannan. Check him out. Listen to his music if you haven't been there yet.
Oh yeah, and the Quarantunes sessions that he's doing right now. He's putting out these little records, like 8-song records, by himself during the quarantine. And if you're listening to this, please go and purchase those, because Corey is being a badass, releasing his own stuff, doing it all himself. And if you have $8, you get 8 songs. So that is a extremely fair deal. And these are the types of artists you should be supporting. So please, please, please go get Corey's Quarantune sessions.
Absolutely.
And be nice to each other out there.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.